Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Who were you supposed to slap with a slapstick?
What dirty jokes made the tutors laugh?
And for whom did we coin the word zany?
We're clowning around with jests, jokes, satire, and spoofs on this comedic episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we are talking about one of my favorite topics, comedy.
Humans love to laugh, and down the centuries, we've coined all kinds of words for laughing and the things that make us laugh. We're going to explore some of those words and their origins. And I tell you what, there's some really good, juicy stuff in this one. I'm excited to get into it. We should start with the etymology of comedy, though. It's not the most exciting etymology we'll get into, but we should give it a mention.
Yeah, I mean, of all the words in here, I think most of them have more story to them. But comedy is from the Greek komodios, which means an actor or a singer or a poet who performed at festivals and revelries, and they would put on komoidia, an amusing spectacle that everyone could enjoy.
Yeah, there's a sort of rowdiness to the thing, to the revelry. It's someone who's performing when everyone else is having a good time. That's a comedy. It doesn't necessarily have to be funny, but it should be fun. Tragedy is, funnily enough, a more fun word, isn't it?
Because it is.
It's thought that the tragos that makes the trag in tragedy means goat. So with the ad at the end also meaning the same as it does in comedy, which is essentially a song, tragedy is a goat song.
Mm-hmm. And that's probably because it's a reference to like satyr stories, right?
Yeah. Again, this is one of those things I don't really know. The source I read said that it was perhaps that, because the original tragedies were competitions for composing odes. And they thought that maybe a goat was the prize. And that's why they were calling them goat songs, which I think is a conceivable idea. A bit of a silly one, but yeah, maybe it's that.
There is a probably apocryphal tale that Thespis, for whom Thespians are named, earned a goat as a prize for winning an acting competition. But goats also come into play with the dithyram, which is a hymn sung to Dionysus. The dithyram was a predecessor of tragedy and usually included a chorus made of people dressed as satyrs.
Right, but we should talk about satyrs because they both are and are not connected with comedy, aren't they? So we have the comic genre of satire, but down the centuries, and including in antiquity, that word was confused with the Greek satires, not the same thing. The words don't come from the same place. The idea of, you know, mocking the prevailing morals of the day, or, you know, as it is today, mocking current affairs, does not come from the Greek satyrs, even though you could have, you know, satiric drama back in the day. It instead comes from a Latin word, satura, which is actually related to saturate, and also words like satisfy and sate. But the original satires are collections of works. It's a miscellany, basically. It's saturated with all kinds of different genre, be it ode or prose, etc.
And then it shifted under, as you said, the influence of the Latin satyr, because it was sort of mistakenly connected with the satire that appeared in Greek satyr drama.
But we know better now, and that these have come from different sources. But you got us there very elegantly with that with that theory about the goats in the tragedies.
I feel like we need one of those screaming goats to appear on screen.
That's taken us to a place that we could explore a little bit more, though: satire and parody and, you know, lampooning and stuff. These are all words that have got stories behind them as well. I've got lampoon actually on my list here. Lampoon from the French lampon, which is from a verb, lamponner, which is to drink. It's to booze. It's to guzzle. So lampon, with an S at the end of it, lampons, you would see it written in English, means let's drink, essentially. It's the version of the verb you would use with we. So lampon, nous lampons, would be we drink.
I recall reading that it's related sort of to the word like lap, as in like lapping up something, which would make sense.
That does make a lot of sense, doesn't it? Yeah, you're drinking something, but more effusively than just a gentle cat lapping at its water. And I mentioned parody as well. The oddy at the end of there is the same as the endings on tragedy and comedy. It's a reference to odes from Greek. And then the para, so paro, but para is what we expect para to be, which is besides, as in like in parallel or something like that. But the original parodies were, well, they were parodies. They were parodies of other genres. They were burlesque imitations of
get into burlesque.
More serious art forms. And burlesque itself is also an imitation, a grotesque imitation of other art forms.
Burlesque first entered English as an adjective, and it meant like droll or odd or grotesque, kind of either way. But it comes from the French burlesque, which was coined in the 16th century from the Italian burlesco, meaning ludicrous. And the root here is the Italian burla, meaning joke or fun or ridicule or mockery. And the esque is in the style of, in the same way that we like tack that onto other things, right?
The sort of sexy angle of burlesque is quite a new thing. That's like a late 19th century American thing where they start working in a striptease into these grotesque performances. They're not grotesque. They're just extravagant, really.
Burla was a comic interlude or a practical joke that was inserted into a performance, often in the masks of Commedia dell'arte, which we'll get into. It was sort of this staged mockery, you might say, just to lighten the mood, keep things lively and going. And then it developed this other theatrical meaning from minstrel show structure, which we can also get into minstrel shows. But it became this variety show format that drew from a bunch of different music hall, cabaret type entertainment. And it had things like dances and boxing matches and spectacles and slapstick and music and chorus numbers, and of course people wearing fewer clothes and singing at the same time.
And you were talking about it being sort of an interlude, is that right?
Originally the Italian burla was.
The reason I'm trying to steer us in that direction is that the word farce essentially means an interlude as well. I don't know if we talked about this before. I definitely put it in my newsletter. The Latin verb farcire means to stuff. The original farces were a sort of silly interlude before two other performances, normally more dramatic performances. So it was just called a stuffing.
Particularly compared to like food stuffing, right?
Yeah. And if you eat a French dish where something has been stuffed in something else, it is called something farci, right? Something stuffed. It is the word that they use in French for stuffing something still.
In France, farce was this comic material that was inserted into like religious dramas and things.
Yeah, you got to lighten the mood while people were getting their, 18th century ice cream.
The distinction here, I believe, is that I've seen it described that farce uses these broadly stylized characters. It's difference between the distinction between satire and parody and burlesque and slapstick kind of come down to, for farce, situation. Like satire targets vice and hypocrisy, yeah. And parody is an imitation. Slapstick is literally the slapstick noise when you pretend to punch someone.
We shouldn't throw away slapstick. That's quite a fun one, isn't it? As well, because we're back with the Italians. Because it's the Italians that invent this device, these two bits of wood that are sort of hinged together almost. So mm-hmm. they smack together and make a loud noise, which is great for using in the wings to make a loud noise when something's happening, or for clowns and the like, when they yes. they whack someone with it, it makes a much louder noise than the hit justifies.
And just to finish the thought, farce uses...
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, no worries. We can get back to that. I would love to talk about clowns, but farce uses basically a bunch of improbable circumstances and escalating chaos and confusion to create this like big tottering, stuffed up cupboard full of plates that's about to crash down, figuratively speaking.
Yeah, it's, farce is still like that. You know, if you go to the theater to see a farce, you're guaranteed a laugh. It won't necessarily be highbrow, but you're guaranteed a laugh. It won't tell you much about society necessarily, but there will be lots of entrances and exits and misunderstandings, etc. Farce is fun.
Lots of mistaken identity and comic misunderstandings and escalating absurdity.
Clowns. Tell us about clowns.
The word clown is a little bit like the word villain in the sense that it literally means it originally meant a person from the countryside, especially a peasant, sort of a coarse, clumsy, poorly educated person. So this is very classist, much in the same way that villain is. It means like a person from the countryside or a peasant farmer. And then later that was associated with moral virtue affiliated with wealth, so to speak. We don't know exactly what the root of this is, but it's a Germanic word, and it probably means something like lump or clot or ball or just a clumsy person. So definitely something heavy and awkward.
That's interesting. It's a Germanic word because I've never looked this one up, but I think I'd always assumed that we got it from, or maybe got it from French. Is that right?
Some of the proposed relatives, they're all Germanic. So all right. Like Dutch has a word, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it means an uncouth person and it looks about the same. There's also a word for peasant or country bumpkin that's very similar. It is entirely possible that it is related to the word clue, which is a ball of thread. And it's that ball lump sense that we've talked about before. The clue being that ball of thread that leads you through the Minotaur's labyrinth.
Yeah, it's very, very fun one, that. That's one of the better etymologies.
The OED does say that there was an older suggestion that clown had to do with colonists, which also meant farmer, but they ultimately reject that because it just the chronology doesn't quite line up.
Yeah, and the idea is that they're country bumpkins. Who's more hilarious than, you know, a poor person?
Right. There were, in particular, a number of like clown-like characters who inspired our modern clowns in Italian Commedia dell'arte, and I think we should get into that next because there's a lot there.
So many of our words surrounding comedy go back to Italian, and it is because of this tradition of Commedia dell'arte.
In case you are unfamiliar, it is this early form of professional theater that begins in Italy, and it's very popular throughout all of Europe. It is characterized by having improvised formulaic scenes that use repeating archetypes and patterns, both in terms of the characters themselves, who often wore distinctive and recognizable masks, and then also many of the scenarios repeated in a familiar way. The scenarios are called lazzi, and an individual one is a lazzo. And so they were these well-rehearsed jokes and stock physical gags, and sometimes on-the-spot improvised episodes and routines. But there are some sort of recurring ones, and people who know more about Commedia dell'arte will probably be able to explain this better, but I looked up a few of them. So one of the recurring lazzi is the lazzo of the mirror, which they star the same stock characters every time. This one is Pantalone and Dottore, and Pantalone and Dottore discover a mirror, and it's another character or characters mimicking them, and the reflections exaggerate their movements and grow more absurd over time, and it turns into ridiculous comedy. And then there's the lazzo of the food, where Brighella, I hope I said that right, cooks a meal and then continually tastes and adds ridiculous ingredients like shoes and books and inedible objects. And then the other characters are either tasting and adding their own additions and reacting in horror.
And the characters from these stories, these stock characters, end up making their way into other cultures around Europe, including in England. And we've definitely talked before about Pantalone, one of the characters, who's this, well, he's Venetian, isn't he? He's a sort of Venetian miser with a high sex drive.
And he's grumpy and he's old and he wears these very distinctive red tights that end up becoming the namesake of Pantaloons, because his name is Pantalone, and then Pants.
And another of the characters is Zanny, right? From which we get the word zany.
Uh-huh.
So Zanny is again, what's Zanny? Zanny is a servant, really, but quite an arch servant and one who's prone to playing tricks. So, you know, it became a thing to call someone a zany or a zany, as English transformed it. And then eventually it just becomes zany. You are zany. But the implication being that you are a zany. You are this sort of quirky character.
And then Harlequin is one of the characters as well, Arlecchino. And that's both the character's name and the name of the patterned costume, right?
Yeah, he's a Burgamese manservant, I think, the Harlequin.
That makes sense.
Again, though, you hear how the people that are being mocked are all like the underlings a lot of the time.
Oh, yeah, of course. We've got Brighella, who I mentioned a minute ago, is a masked servant who is clever and manipulative and cruel. And Scapino is a servant figure who uses trickery and deception to help or hinder other people. And a lot of them are servants and lower class people. And the characters who are higher class are like the Pantalone character, who's an elderly merchant, and Il Dottore, who is a scholar or a doctor who talks and talks and talks and presents himself as highly educated, and Il Capitano is a soldier, things like that.
But this Harlequin character, Arlecchino, is quite an interesting one, because obviously we know the word Harlequin as something akin to a jester, I suppose. But traditionally, on stage, Harlequin was sort of this invisible trickster that couldn't be seen by Pantalone and or the clown sort of characters. They couldn't see them, which meant that the Harlequin was able to get up to all kinds of mischief. I'm fascinated by how many words we have for the sort of jester and joker.
Tons.
And Harlequin and fool. Yeah, and I found a new one the other day. I popped this one in my newsletter because I hadn't come across it before. A dizzard.
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 What's the, I mean, I know what the ending is. It's my favorite
yes,
ending.
You do.
But what is the first part?
I think the spelling has been informed by the word dizzy, but it comes from a French word meaning to speak. So a disant would be someone who speaks.
Ah, right? Okay.
So originally the dizzard was a person in court who spoke, so who entertained, who told stories. But then it becomes, you know, something akin to a fool. And then in English, you know, to be called a dizzard would be an insult. It would be in exactly the same way that you get the idea of someone being an idiot from, you know, originally an entertaining fool to then just being, you know, you're a fool. The same happens with the word dizzard, but we've lost the word dizzard, unfortunately. Oh. We've still got the word fool. We've lost dizzard. But buffoon's a good one. Buffoon, again, goes to Italian, buffone, but comes to us from French, from bouffon. And it's thought that it's sort of almost onomatopoeia, the first syllable of that, the buff being sort of the idea of puffing your cheeks to get a laugh, really, sort of, you know, so it's like a puffer.
That oon ending is interesting. We've seen it on Lampoon and Buffoon, and it's a little bit of a moving target. It's usually an interpretation of either the French on or the Italian one ending, just O-N-E or O-N. And in English, it gets tacked onto all kinds of things.
And it's in this weird form in Middle English, where it's usually, it goes from the French on to the English oon. Usually spelled like O-U-N, isn't it? Words that have come, I don't know if that, a sort of an Anglo-Norman hangover. I think it perhaps is that the dialect of French that is being spoken in England has oon sounds, where the French that we're more used to now has on sounds. I suppose it probably did.
You tend to find it on sometimes pejorative words, but then it also ends up on a sort of an agent ending as well. Like
yeah.
You'll see it on shabaroon and spittoon, but then you see it on quadroon and things like that, which aren't negative. So it's interesting.
Good point. Did you say you'd got some revelations about jesters?
Oh, I sure do. The word jest in general. So a jest is not originally a joke. So a jest, G-E-S-T, which is the predecessor to this word, was originally a story of achievements or adventures. One of the most famous medieval jests is this piece called Gesta Francorum, which is the jest of the Franks, by Fulcher of Chartres, which is a Latin chronicle of the First Crusade, written by this priest named Fulcher, who participated in the Crusade. And jester was originally a word for a professional storyteller or a minstrel or a professional reciter of romances. And not until the 15th century, this started in like the 13th century, but by the 15th century, it was any sort of court entertainer. And of course, they were quite silly. And a jest, meanwhile, shrank down to a less grand story, just something you would tell over your ale.
So actually, that's quite similar to the story I was telling about Dizzards, right?
Yeah.
They start off as a storyteller and then become a teller of silly stories and then a teller of silly jokes. I also looked up joke, by the way, the origin of joke. I mean, it's not one of the more controversial origins. I mean, it's from Latin jocus, but it's got some relatives in other languages that are quite interesting, like the French jeu and jouer, which mean game and play, respectively. And obviously, more directly from the Latin, we get jocular and jocund as well.
One thing that we didn't quite address in Commedia dell'arte is that the word punch in the context of comedy, like the character Punch and Judy, and then I believe the punchline as well, ultimately is from the notion. Is from Commedia dell'arte.
I was looking up whether I'm not convinced anymore, because I got it in my head that punchline was related to Punch and Judy.
I think it's older than that, because there was a character in Commedia dell'arte called Pulcinella, and Punch and Judy is based on that. Both of them involved a puppet, essentially.
I'm not sure the term punchline goes back far enough, though. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, okay. That might make sense.
It's a 20th century term. It could be that it is invoking that idea of punch, but I just think it's far more conceivable that it's because it is the line that is that gives you a punch. You
know, yeah, that makes
the
sense.
The line at the end with the impact. Do you have Punch and Judy shows in America?
No, but I'm familiar with them because I read a lot. I mean, they're not unfamiliar to your average person. I don't think so.
Right.
I think most Americans probably have heard of Punch and Judy. And the magazine Punch in particular also made its way across the pond.
Yeah, satirical magazine named after one of the two main characters in the Punch and Judy shows. I mean, I saw a lot of Punch and Judy shows as a child. For people who, I mean, if you don't know what it is a small puppet show done in sort of like a little shack that they put outside with a little window. And it's essentially a little stage. And it involves a lot of domestic violence, basically. Punch and Judy beating each other with sticks. There's always a policeman mm-hmm. involved as well, chasing them around. Kids absolutely love it. It's not terribly politically correct. But like we talked about pantomime as well, somehow these things manage to endure, nevertheless.
The word punch is not specifically from comedy. It means like puncture or poke something, and it's originally from the French ponchonner, which means to punch or prick or stamp or something. And ponchon is a pointed tool or a piercing weapon.
Do you use the word gag in the States for a joke?
Yeah, sure.
It's one of those ones that people don't know. It might be from the sound you make when you laugh. But again, we keep mentioning the OED because this is where we do like to look for these things. And it says that it's possibly invoking a thrusting something down the throat of an incredulous person, because this is a key detail. Gags were not originally jokes. Gags were tricks.
I am.
By gagging someone, are you figuratively seeing how much they can swallow? What they would swallow? You know, how far you can push the trick? How far you can push the scam?
Oh, that makes sense. That's good.
Yeah, it's interesting. But it might be onomatopoeia. It just simply might be like a lot of our words for laughing are like giggle, snicker, snigger, guffaw. Guffaw is a good one. Guffaw is a Scottish word.
Ooh.
Scots had a verb, gawf, which is to laugh.
Oh, that's great.
And from that we get guffaw.
Totally unrelated, but it reminds me that chortle is a portmanteau coined by Lewis Carroll.
Yes.
And we just use it regularly. I guess not in everyday conversation, but it comes up, you know?
Yeah, it's a good one. They do like a comedy awards in Britain called the Chortle Awards.
Oh, that's fun. That's cute.
And snort, Chortle is chuckle and snort, is there a portmanteau of those?
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Could I pause to tell you a couple of jests from history?
I don't know why, just because your name is Jess. When you mention that, I think, jests from history, it feels double like there's an extra S in the middle on the poster. Go on, give us some Jess's jests from history.
I found a work called, there are a couple different works called Shakespeare's Jest Book from the Tudor period that were collections of humorous anecdotes that were published within a few years of each other, and they're framed as having influenced some of Shakespeare's humor. We have no idea if they did or not, or like what era all of the jokes are from, but there was the 100 Merry Tales from 1526 and the Merry Tales and Quick Answers from 1530. So there are, and they're compiled into one sometimes called Shakespeare's Jest Book. And we do see things like our Merry Tales of the Mad Men of Gotham referenced in this, not in full, but there will be a little short blurb about the men of Gotham doing ridiculous things to convince the king not to build his road through the town. But some of these jokes are filthy, like absolutely filthy. Like there's one, it's in Elizabethan English, so I'm going to translate it to modern English. But there is one about a woman standing by a river and washing her clothes. And because she keeps squatting down, her dress gets caught in her butt crack and shows off the outline of her other bits. And a friar comes up and makes a joke that's like, the horse is biting his bridle. And she says, Master Friar, he's just wiping his mouth so you'll come and kiss him. Absolutely filthy. And that's not the worst one I read. But on the lighter side, I also looked up a mid-19th century selection of jokes called The Jest Book by Mark Lemon. And this one has tamer ones. Some of them are a little, they're not politically correct by any means, but they're definitely, they're meant to be more family friendly. But there's one, for example, that says, the following admonition was addressed by a Quaker to a man who was pouring forth a volley of ill language against him. Have a care, friend, thou mayest run thy face against my fist, which I feel like that joke is like, that sounds like a modern joke, right?
Yeah. Couched stop hitting in yourself. Archaic language. Yeah. Watch it, mate. You're going to run into my fist.
It's great. This one's fun. A loving husband once waited on a physician to request him to prescribe for his wife's eyes, which were very sore. I don't know what's wrong with your eyes if they're sore. And the doctor advises her to wash them with a small glass of brandy. Again, I think that might make it worse. Anyway, a few weeks later, the doctor chanced to meet the husband. Well, my friend, has your wife followed my advice? She's done everything in her power to do it, doctor, said the spouse, but she never could get the glass higher than her mouth.
Very good. Very good.
Yes. This one, I'm going to do one more and then we can move on. But I have...
I'm enjoying these. Well, to be honest, the first one was far too raw. But these lighter
it's
ones...
It's so evocative.
Yeah. Anyway. I could really see it.
Just see it, yeah. anyway, this one, like... The framing of it is not politically correct, but it's actually the punchline is profound. So I'm and not even funny profound, just like actually profound. So the joke goes, a lunatic in Bedlam was asked how he came to be there, and he answered, by a dispute. Someone asked, what dispute? The Bedlamite replied, the world said I was mad. I said the world was mad, and they outwitted me. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, my goodness.
It's clever.
Yeah, it is. It's clever. It's clever.
It's not a joke, though, is it?
No, it's not a joke. It's more like, it's like a, it's, social commentary.
It's a witticism.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it is. That's what it is. Whoa. Cutting.
Anyway, we should move back to forms of comedy.
Oh, yeah.
When we were in England together, you mentioned a panto, and I was like, you mean a pantomime? Because I hadn't heard of a panto before, which maybe I should have, but I hadn't, and it sounded like something that I've been to in the States. But first, can you tell us what a panto is and what it has to do with pantomime?
Well, it's panto is just short for pantomime, but our understanding of pantomime in Britain is not the traditional understanding of pantomime. Pantomime is just a mime.
Yeah. Really.
But a British pantomime is a Christmas play. It's usually a fairy tale story, a fairy story told with music, bright colours, a lot of cross-dressing. There are, like in the Commedia dell'arte, there's stock characters like the Dame, which is always a man, usually a middle-aged man, dressed up as a woman, usually plays the mother of the leading man, who is always played by a woman. And it's also, they're incredibly good fun. And I mentioned a panto, it was during my show that I mentioned it, I think, because there's an interlude. It always ends, almost always ends. No, let's say it always ends with a wedding between the leading man and the leading woman. And that is always quite a sort of extravagant affair, requires a set change. So during the set change, what they do is they bring out the words to a song and everyone gets to sing the song. So this is in front of the, is it called the envelope? In front of the curtain.
Mm-hmm.
we'll do a sing song while they get everything ready for the wedding at the back. Yeah, and there are all these little traditions like that. There's a lot of back and forth with the audience, a lot of call and response. Oh, no, he didn't. Oh, yes, he did. Oh, no, he didn't. A lot of shouting, he's behind you. He's behind you. Honestly, these are shown around Christmas. A lot of amateur companies will put them on. It'll be their big production, their big money spinner. A lot of amateur dramatics companies, it's the only way that they stay afloat is that they put on a pantomime each year. Because it's one of those things where you can see it done badly and still have a very, very good time. And we'll have to get you over at Christmas one time and take you to panto.
That sounds great. It sounds a little Rocky Horror-ish as well.
I mean, it's certainly got all the cross-dressing and music of Rocky Horror Picture.
And the interaction bits as well, right?
But the thing about it is it's targeted at children as well as adults. So it's filled with double entendre. Like the jokes are never overtly sexual, or at least if they are, there's a way that the sentence can be interpreted by a child that is innocent.
So I was looking at the kind of the evolution of the term like you said, it means a mime originally. The notion is performing. I'm not sure if the sense is you perform with your whole body or you can perform anything. A pantomime in the Roman Empire was a performer who acted out mythological stories through kind of expressive gesture and dance and movement. So they might make sound, but they were still acting out through their bodies. And then in the 18th century, it moved into ballet and movement-based storytelling. Again, could have sound and things. But then the British pantomime sense seems to have come primarily from Commedia dell'arte, like applying the same notions that we mentioned before. Apparently, it's tied closely to the Harlequinade, which is a comic stage form based on those figures as well. Apparently in those, Harlequin often receives a magic wand and then he drives the action through a bunch of changes and chases and tricks and transformations.
In the States, you have this theater tradition of vaudeville. We don't really have it in Britain. I think our equivalent is called music hall. Can you tell me about vaudeville?
I sure can. It comes from Chanson du Vaudevire. It is the song of the Valley of Vire, which is in Normandy. And the phrase was applied to these satirical popular songs that were associated with Olivier Bassillon, which was a 15th century poet from Vire. That's one potential option. A second explanation might be that it's related to words like vaudé, meaning to go, and vire, meaning to turn, but the Vir Valley explanation is one that you see a lot. The idea here is that it's a country song, essentially, and that's what you experience when you experience. It's funny, you would say vaudeville, right? And I have heard both vaudeville and vaudeville in American English dialects. Apparently, both are okay.
It's interesting from what you were saying about the origin of it, that the vil at the end of it is sort of a misunderstanding, either in English or I don't know, earlier in French, because it should be vir, not vil.
It's correcting, but it's correcting to another French word.
Yeah, they've done well. Got the right language.
Phono-semantically matched the wrong language.
Hey, there we go. Phono-semantic matching.
Hey. Anyway, vaudeville is basically a variety show, and it tends to involve dancers and singers and musicians and magicians and ventriloquists, which, did you know that ventriloquist originally meant, it means belly talking, essentially.
Speaker. It wasn't
a word for what we now call a ventriloquist. It was...
It's not an entertainment. It's like a possession by a demon, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Like a rumbling internal speech, like The Exorcist.
Yeah.
And then it was extended, presumably because the notion is that, like, you can't see their mouths moving.
They're doing a lot more of the speaking down. Can you do it? Can you talk without moving your mouth?
No.
There's that joke. Would you like a bottle of beer or a wine? I'll have a wine. Because you can't say bottle of beer. The hardest thing is not bringing your lips together.
Vaudeville also covers things like Wild West shows and riverboat shows and music halls and burlesques and circus acts. You kind of do everything with vaudeville, but it was typically considered more family entertainment than burlesque shows.
We already talked about parody and lampoon, but there's another word in that sort of dialectic, isn't there, which is spoof.
It's a funny word, right?
Yeah, it's a spoof. Again, it's a word that doesn't go back that far.
It's based on a game, right?
Yeah, it's a card game. Yeah, called Spoof. So either invented by or just resurrected by a music hall comedian. So I've talked about music hall. So basically, I'm calling him a comedian, but he could turn his hand to everything. These people could. They could sing, they could dance, they could do everything. But his name was Arthur Roberts. And in the 1880s, he popularized this game of cards called Spoof, sometimes spelled S-P-O-O-F, sometimes spelled S-P-O-U-F. And it would appear that a large part of the game was tricking people.
Which is common in card games.
Yeah, exactly. So actually, in a similar way to, we can talk about trumping someone, that comes from the game of trumps. You start being able to talk about spoofing someone from the game of spoof, you know, tricking them. That's where spoof comes from.
Mm-hmm. And so how did we get from spoof to like parody? It's not parody, but it has elements of parody, you know what I mean?
Well, spoofing, for example, radar. So if you spoof a radar, that means you have tricked that radar into thinking something is there that is not there. So from those kinds of usages of trickery via spoofing, you then end up with the idea of faking something that is real. And that's what, so a film spoof is a fake version of the real thing, you know.
So that's like Scary Movie taking the whole genre of horror films and making a fake funny one.
They spoofed it, exactly.
I would love to talk about the word travesty, because this was first in English a word for a comedic form as well, right? Travesty means it's trans and vestire, so to clothe across, it's cross-dressing, something reclothed or cross-dressed. And in English literary use, it was a burlesque treatment of a serious work, especially when that kept the subject and the characters while making the language low or grotesque or absurd. So like parody changes the subject while imitating the style, and travesty keeps the subject and the characters, but then drags everything through the mud. And so a travesty became any distorted or inferior or grotesquely inadequate version of what something should be. So we have like a travesty of justice, which is like one of the early earliest phrases that we have.
That is one of those etymologies that is going to change how I use that word.
Right.
Ever so slightly. Etymologically, it means the same thing as transvestism, basically, travesty. But it's a figurative wearing of someone else's clothes, is it?
Yeah, it's figurative.
We have lots of words that figuratively use that sort of idea of vestment, don't we? Like invest.
It is basically a doublet of the word transvestite, but with a different ending and a different sense, right? But it in French, it went from like French and Italian dropped the N and the S, so it became travestir, which meant dressed in disguise, but not necessarily cross-dressed, just like different dressed. All right, I will round us out with a few more jokes that I pulled from history. These aren't bad, I promise. No, horses nibbling at anything.
Those centuries old camel toe.
Yes.
Oh, I've just said the word camel toe on a microphone. I've said it twice.
Oh, beautiful. Anyway, these are a little less ridiculous, but these are vaudeville jokes that were collected by the Wayman Brothers, which was this New York-based publisher active in the early 20th century that specialized in low-cost, paper-bound entertainment jokes and parlor tricks and magic and songbooks and things like that. So I have a couple of these. One of them, George Washington was the bravest man in the world. He was never licked in his life. Oh, yes, he was. He was licked on a postage stamp. Then they had to do it behind his back.
Okay. Very droll. It's droll. And then I'll give them droll.
Yes, yes. A lot of these were woo-hoo. And they're meant to be very family friendly. Like, for example, it has been asked, when rain falls, does it ever get up again? Of course it does. In due time. Ah.
I actually like that one.
Oh, yeah, that's fun.
I like that one. Yeah, okay.
That's a good pun. And you know, we really didn't pun. Do pun.
Yeah, I don't think it's a very interesting story pun. I think it's one of those, really not really sure where it comes from. It's just a syllable, not a lot to go on with where the word pun comes from.
Anyway, I think that was a fine, good, a rollicking good time.
Yeah, so much needed bit of comic relief for us all. Thank you so much, Jess. You made me laugh. I've made me blush. Another episode of Worlds Unraveled completes the full bingo card.
We'll see you next time.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.